When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Mail checks, invoices, documents, and everything you need to keep your business running. Get rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS. And with the mobile app, you can take care of mailing on the go. Make the same no-brainer decisions as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Welcome to episode 77 of Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This podcast is listener-supported. Our patrons donate monthly to support the production and development of the podcast. If you would like to support us, visit our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And don't forget to listen to the end of this episode for our traditional patron shout-out. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the other co-host, Maciek Makulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode. Each week, we bring you a discussion on topics related to our region. As a reminder, Talk Eastern Europe is a member of Europod Network, a network of European podcasts covering a range of social and political issues. This episode is a cooperation between Talk Eastern Europe, the Memory Studies Association, and EuroClio, the European Association of History Educators. This initiative is part of Contested Histories On-Site, a project powered by European Commission and the Europe for Citizens program.
Thanks, Maciek. We are really excited to be a part and a partner of this project, which covers such an important topic. So let's get started. So as Maciek mentioned in our intro, this special episode of Talk Eastern Europe is a part of the Contested Histories On-Site project. It's a valuable and worthwhile project in which the organizers attempt to look at issues of clashing perceptions of history and their potential to stimulate divisions in society. One of the aims of the project is to provide educators with an educational toolkit, which will be handy to teach people how to actually use history not to divide, but to bring them closer together and make the discourse on the past more constructive. But since we are not the organizers of the project, but partners, we really encourage you to visit the project's website to learn more about it, and you will find the link in the show notes below the podcast.
Exactly, and we were invited by the Memory Studies Association and EuroClio to record a podcast as a side event of their Contested Histories On-Site project. And since one of the project's events took place in a digital space of Warsaw Rising Museum, we decided to record an interview with the project's expert to talk about this museum itself, and also what is the role of such institution, what is the role they have to play. And the expert is Maria Kobielska, a memory scholar from the Jagiellonian University in Krakow, and she gave us a lot of insights how to look at such institutions from very different perspectives, and also how different societies in Europe deal with the totalitarian history they experience and often turbulent and dramatic events from the past.
Indeed, I think the Warsaw Rising Museum is a good trigger for a broader discussion on memory, and I'm sure that our listeners will find this discussion interesting. Maciek, have you ever been to the Warsaw Rising Museum in Warsaw?
Yes, I still remember the first time I went there. I think I spent there about 5 hours.
And wow.
It was, you don't feel it like that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's a real experience. Yeah. You feel that you touch history. And also, this was the first museum of this type I visited in my life. So, of course, when you visit many of such institutions, you are somehow prepared for this kind of experience. But if it is your first time, it's, I think, quite a unique experience.
Yeah, absolutely. It is definitely worth a visit. And for any of our listeners out there who are who come to Warsaw, I highly recommend it as well. As you mentioned, it was the first of this type of museum in Poland, and we talk about that in the interview in a moment. So check out the links that we have provided in the show notes to this episode about the project Contested Histories on Site. And now, without further ado, we invite you to listen to our interview with Maria Kobielska.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/prenatal.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We are joined now by Maria Kobielska, a memory scholar working at the Faculty of Polish Studies of Jagiellonian University in Krakow. She specializes in contemporary Polish memory culture and new Polish historical museums. Hello, Maria. It's a real pleasure to have you here today. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, and thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure for me as well.
Our conversation is taking place on the margins of the Contested Histories on-site project, during which one of the first events took place in Warsaw at the Warsaw Uprising Museum. And the topic of our talk is how we as societies in general deal with the often traumatic past and what are the roles of the cultural institutions like Warsaw Uprising Museum in such processes. But before we delve into this, I would like to start with a question about the Warsaw Uprising Museum itself, because this is one of the most popular museum in Warsaw and in Poland, I believe. And even before the pandemic, in the year, for instance, 2019, over 700,000 visitors visit this museum. And during the pandemic last year, it was 800,000 of people who visited somehow digital Warsaw Uprising Museum. And I wanted to ask you, what is behind the phenomenon of such institutions as the Warsaw Uprising Museum? Why do we need them and why are they so popular?
Okay, so I guess that this question can be asked in many different contexts and many factors need to be acknowledged to try to sketch the answer. The first thing I would notice is the context of the so-called, let's say, Polish museum landscape. As we all may know, or maybe not, we are experiencing in Poland something that can be called a museum boom during the last, let's say, 15 to 20 years. New museums open every year, while older ones renew their permanent exhibitions, and it all is to an increasing number of visitors. So basically we can say that museums are perceived as more and more interesting, attractive spaces just to pass time. And it was the Warsaw Rising Museum that was the first to attract such attention when it opened to the public in 2004. So it was 17 years ago. So the Warsaw Rising Museum can be seen as a kind of a pioneer of this Polish museum boom we may notice everywhere in the country. So, and I guess that this special position of the museum as this pioneer stands behind its, let's say, extreme popularity. I guess that it was the first such experience for many Polish visitors to visit a new type of a museum, and it just happened in the Warsaw Uprising Museum itself. To somehow sketch briefly, what kind of a museum is it? I would say that we encounter here exhibitions that are spectacular. They use diverse media, engage different senses of the visitors, encourage visitors to interact with the exhibition, and present an attractive story or a historical narrative. They produce intensive, attractive, and diverse experiences rather than, you know, educate in a traditional way. And consequently, they are much more attractive also as a pastime. They require from the visitors a kind of active attention, exploration, interpretation, and therefore they are so interesting or even captivating. So this is like the first reason I would point to, that the Warsaw Rising Museum is this special place when this Polish museum boom started and is still attracting visitors because of its special position. The second thing is basically the context of Polish memory culture as such. I would say that Poles are generally interested in the past. Past is very important in Polish culture, at least since 19th century, when national memory was seen as a source of hope for the future. And of course, the experience of the 20th century with its traumas, dependencies, stories of fighting and so on, also require a kind of attention, working through representation. That's why I would say that historical museums are somehow interesting generally for many people in Poland. And when they offer this special kind of experience, these two factors somehow combine.
I wanted to follow up with what you talked about, especially this museum boom that Poland is experiencing. I wanted to ask, would you say this is a general trend more globally or at least in Western countries, or is this specific to Poland? And what do you think maybe is driving this boom? Is it kind of a more public or national political initiatives or local government or private or NGO or combination? I'm curious on what are the factors that drive this boom of museums in Poland?
So of course there is the global context. So this general idea of a museum that is encouraging visitors with these multi-sensual experiences, of course, it's not solely a Polish invention. And there were some, let's say, models that inspired Polish museum creators from the beginning of the 21st century. So, of course, we have this kind of general global context. But there are also similar phenomena in other countries of the region of East Central Europe. So I guess that all these contexts are combined somehow. But I have this impression as someone who spends a lot of time investigating museums and new museums in particular, that this boom developed in the Polish context on a special level somehow. And of course, the vast majority of museums in Poland are public institutions. Sometimes they are running a kind of public and private cooperation with public institutions or regional authorities or national authorities cooperate with NGOs, for instance. Mm-hmm. But generally speaking, museum is a very big enterprise. It needs a big budget, especially when the exhibition is supposed to be so spectacular as the exhibition of the Warsaw Rising Museum, for instance. Mm. And that's why it's generally publicly funded in the Polish context. And this, of course, also creates some opportunities for the authorities to somehow show these new museums as a kind of, you know, successful narratives about the governing country or the particular region in a good way. And at the same time, these museums, especially historical museums, can also be become tools of memory politics. Mm-hmm. So that's when this, let's say, political sphere and public sphere and museum landscape are intertwined.
I think we will come to the question about politics of memory.
Yeah.
It is a very interesting thread, but I would like to ask one more question that refers to the second part of the explanation why the Warsaw Rising Museum is popular. You have said that Poles in general are interested in the past, and I was thinking about that. That can we say that this is kind of a, I don't know, social need that is inside us, and then the, you know, the popularity of such museums stems from the fact that they are modern, they offer something new, which is also exciting, but also strengthens some kind of our, I don't know, and there's a question: in what way they meet this social need? Maybe those museums strengthens, you know, some national myths or strengthens national identity. So what is this kind of you know, how to call it, experience they offer to the people?
So of course it depends, but basically I would say that yes, majority of the Polish historical museums offer this kind of perspective, which is, let's say, focused on a kind of a common experience of for the group, for the community, which is basically the Polish community. So this Polish national perspective is constructed as the default one. And of course, it is from this point of view, we may say that it is somehow pleasant to visit this kind of a museum, even when it deals with difficult historical experiences, traumas, and so on, because this is the space when this our experience and our perspective is generally somehow placed in the center. So it can be somehow pleasant or captivating in this regard. And of course, they basically dialogue with, like you said, national myths or memory cliches that we recognize as something which is very well known and to some extent forms a core of our collective identity. But of course, it's not always like that. I wouldn't like to, you know, create this impression that all these museums operate in a kind of very similar way. Mm. I think that in many of the museum's narratives, you will also find, you know, negotiations with this general mainstream national model. For instance, when we want to somehow include regional experiences, local experiences that may somehow differ from this, let's say, general and sometimes simplified narrative about the so-called Polish faith.
Moving kind of along in that the tone that we've been talking about, especially on the idea of collective memory, I wanted to ask about how it fits into the age of political polarization, which we currently are existing in. Do you think that collective memory can be through these types of museums, for example, is it a bridge for reconciliation within a society? Or at the same time, we see it can also be a divisive in society as well. Poland, for example, is a very homogeneous society, but we still see that memory and history are a source of social disputes and divisions within the communities. So I'm curious what you think about how these kind of institutions play a role, either both as a bridge, but also as a more dividing factor.
So I think that there is a term in memory studies that can be useful in the context of thinking about polarization and memories. Mm. There is a memory scholar from the US, Michael Rothberg, who says that we are generally used to thinking about memory in terms of, let's say, competitiveness. So we think about memory, collective memory, and so on, in terms of limited space, zero-sum game, as he says. So, for instance, if we find a place for one vision of the past somewhere in the public space, of one version of memory, we would have to exclude something else to make space for one memory. We need to get rid of the other. And that's why different memories, and of course, these memories stand also for the groups that remember collectively in a way or another. So generally, in this from this perspective, memories compete. Mm. And it is true that we often find this way of thinking about memory as something that comes very natural. For instance, when we think about, you know, a new monument that can be established somewhere, we can basically put one new monument, and it would be strange to, for instance, put three new monuments in one city space somewhere. But of course, it can happen as well. But generally, Michael Rothberg's idea is that we can reframe this thinking about memory in such a way to think about it in terms of multi-directional memories rather than these competitive memories. And for instance, he says that in his country, there is sometimes this competition between remembering atrocities like the Holocaust and remembering American history of slavery. But he also finds examples of such, let's say, memory activities, commemorations, books, films, and so on, that juxtapose these seemingly competing memories, not to compare them, not to create this competition, but to establish a kind of solidarity. So we can try to use this idea to be inspired about thinking about collective memory as this kind of bridge, as you called it, rather than as a reason to somehow fight to compete. But of course, it is something that may happen, that can be found somewhere within the memory culture, but it would be rather hard to expect that generally this field of public debate will be organized fully in terms of this, let's say, solidarity and empathy. Why is that? I guess it happens also in homogeneous societies like Polish, because all kinds of social groups use sometimes the past and memory as a kind of litmus test for recognizing us and them. So, for instance, we have this opinion or a kind of memory commemoration concerning the Warsaw Uprising, and we can build something like a collective identity of those who remember about this historical event in a certain way. And that's where this collective identity can be established. And of course, when it happens, it creates also these divisions and boundaries between those who remember in one way and those who remember in another. Mm. So that's how these remembering communities can be created. And I guess that's where social debates and social disputes as well are created. And I wouldn't say this is a bad thing. I don't think that in a democratic society, we should basically have one common vision of the past and one very unified memory about what happened to our group, to our nation, to this land, and so on in the past.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you that it's enriching experience if we have different perspectives and different memories within a society or among societies. But I think also that here is the place where the concept of politics of memory fits nicely to our conversation, because I think every national politics of memory is done to achieve some political goals or might be used in that way. And what is worse, we also experience that very often politicians prefer these distinctions to us and them, this looking at different events from the past or current events. So maybe politics of memory here is an obstacle to achieve what you have described in a very interesting way, this process, I mean, of having different memories less competitive.
For sure it is like that. But at the same time, basically we can say that, you know, politics of memory or historical politics, this is not inherently a bad thing. This is not something that only, you know, authoritarian or semi-authoritarian governments do.
I hope I wasn't sound like that, because it wasn't it wasn't something sure. What I wanted to say.
Yes. So basically, when we talk about politics of memory, we think about, you know, trying to somehow modify or solidify a kind of remembering the past collectively with the use of various means, and of course on the and of course, it happens publicly on the public forum. So in this context, of course, not only politicians, political parties and so on, but also NGOs, museums, writers, artists make politics of memory to some extent. And we can find various politics of memory. Some of them would be more competitive, I would say, and some more multidirectional. But you are, of course, right that when we observe that something like the mainstream official politics of memory emerges and is being more and more competitive in this context, used to create these boundaries between us and them, and to create this general feeling that we are a group, and this group is like the most important, what we have, and that the most important thing we have to do is to somehow protect our group and protect our point of view. This is something that can block any multidirectional dialogue, and this can have very unpleasant results in the context of international politics, of course, but also in the context of, let's say, social exclusion within the country.
It was I'm it's very interesting so far, this discussion. I really appreciate your perspective, and I also agree with what you've said about that it's actually healthy to have a debate about history and about memory, and we shouldn't all agree on the same narrative. Mm. And I think about, because I originally come from the U.S., and I think about a lot of what's happening there right now, and we see how a lot of monuments which were put up for one purpose are now becoming, changing actually the meaning behind it. For example, if we think about Confederate statues, which are now reminders of racism or reminders of the Civil War or slavery. Are there any examples in that you can think of in Poland where, like, kind of where a monument or type of institution that was put up for one purpose has changed now as a kind of a reminder for a different sense? Does anything come to your mind?
That's an interesting question. And of course, in the American context you mentioned, we have plenty of examples now. And just to add one thing to this topic, what I find extremely interesting also from, and also somehow it can be inspiring from our point of view, is that, of course, many statues, like Confederate statues and so on, are being pulled down.
That's true.
But what was the most interesting instance for me was this version, let's say, of the story, when a monument is not pulled down, but it's being used to another purpose. I guess this happened to one of the statue in Richmond, as far as I remember, that it was covered with graffiti and it was used as to screen some new materials that actually changed this meaning of a monument, of the monument once again, to it reinterpreted it. So we had this situation that originally, when the statue was erected, it meant something basically like, how to say it, a pride, Confederate pride. Mm-hmm. Then it was, when it was revealed that for many people it means violence and oppression. And then when it was changed without being pulled down, it started meaning something totally different, like emancipation and people overtaking the power for themselves during this massive protest that happened. But of course, this is not the Polish case. So just to come back to your question about this, let's say, contested memories, mm-hmm. spaces and monuments in Poland. Of course, we had many instances of this, let's say, change of meaning in the context of monuments and landmarks that come from the communist times. Sometimes they are now perceived as just some kind of a nostalgic building or space that is associated with childhood or with being young, something like that. Mm. Sometimes they are seen by some as a trace of this dependency, this what happened during the communist times when Poland was basically dependent on the Soviet Union. But as we know, only some of these kind of monuments were pulled down, and they were basically Lenin's, as far as I remember, and also some concerning some high Soviet officials. But still, as we know, we have debates around the monuments that represent, for instance, the Red Army in Poland. And so there are violent, I would say, debates about whether they should be liquidated or they should be left there, maybe with some additional boards explaining their meanings and so on. But of course, we can also see how some, let's say, memory trends or commemorative trends mean different things in different times for different groups of people. And for instance, coming back to the Warsaw Rising Museum, of course, It is a space when the anti-Nazi uprising of 1944 is being commemorated in the context of, let's say, this kind of national myth about heroic resistance and fight for independence. But for many, this historical event is also perceived as a kind of a deep personal and collective trauma because of the destruction of the city and this extremely high rate of deaths that happened at the time. Here, attention can be created, but I guess that both memories can be acknowledged at the same time, but it would require a space for discussion. And actually, in the Warsaw Rising Museum, when we think about the exhibition, it shows, of course, the Warsaw Uprising as a kind of traumatic tragedy, but leaves no space for those who are not sure whether the uprising should be organized, should have been organized in the context of its tragic result. We have, in the context of this discussion, we have one point of view, which is default in the museum space. And that's also where a kind of boundary, a kind of, let's say, mechanism of exclusion can be quite a subtle way created via this museum space as such. Mm.
Yeah, and as you were speaking, especially about this, the communist monuments which were taken down or have kind of changed meaning, I think about the Plac Centralny and Nowa Huta, which was had a big Lenin statue in it, was Lenin Square, and now it's renamed to Ronald Reagan. So yes. It's also interesting how the approach to memory, like almost the exact opposite of what it was previously.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, it is interesting that in both cases, we have, let's say, a patron who is not a Polish hero, basically. Yeah. So it's like that to somehow to highlight that we that we do not accept this, let's say, Soviet patronage or Soviet context. We established an American context, for instance, rather than choose a name of a kind of, you know, Polish hero or a group that was a part of Polish history and had some merits that would require acknowledgement. Yeah. So this is interesting as well, that the search for, let's say, international acknowledgement and international appreciation.
If I may contribute really quickly to this topic of redefinition of monuments, because it's really interesting. One story I have is from my hometown in Upper Silesia region in Dąbrowa Górnicza, because there was also such a story that at the beginning of the 90s, the local authorities wanted to destroy such monument built during the Soviet period. But the young people, the youth from Dąbrowa, liked the area around the monument because it was like a meeting place in the city center. And they defended this monument and renamed it after Jimi Hendrix. And they saved the monument. It's still there. And I like this story because it shows also that this redefinition can be also a bottom-up process. Initiated not by the authorities of a city or a state, but also by local community, youngsters in this case. And the second example I like is from the Baltic Sea region, because their authorities of those countries decided not to destroy all the Soviet monuments, but relocate them to one place. So they created, in fact, some kind of an open-air museums in which all
parks
exactly, yes, where all these monuments are put together. There is such a park in Lithuania, and in Estonia, if I am not mistaken. So this is also, I think it is also part of this topic you described.
Yes, and it's also a kind of an answer to this question. What to do with this, let's say, contested past and its traces, like monuments or buildings. And of course, when we talk about monuments, it is possible to just relocate them, to somehow create a special space, which is for the monuments we no longer identify with, for instance. Mm. But of course, we can also, in many contexts, it's not possible. For instance, from time to time, there are discussions raised about whether we should destroy the palace for culture and science in Warsaw, which is perceived as a kind of, let's say, a trace of the Soviet domination. But if seriously speaking, it's not possible because so many institutions just have their headquarters in there that it would require building somewhere something even bigger or of this size immediately after this destruction, and at the same time would have very bad results for all these institutions, cultural institutions, offices, and so on that are located there. So what we can do is to somehow reinterpret this contested heritage, let's say.
Right. Time is running quickly. I think I will now ask the last question, or at least introduce the last topic of our discussion. And I would like to come back to the idea of making different memories less competitive, as you described it before. And now I am embracing the idea. I think there is a huge role of education here, right? And do you think that we should pay more attention to the way we teach and learn about history in general, but also this collective memory?
Yes, but I think that we should consider what we really want to say when we answer yes to this kind of question. Mm. I do not mean that we should have, like, you know, more history lessons at school necessarily, or more formal education in the context of history and patriotic education, let's say, about heritage and about national past. What I guess we really need more in the context of formal and informal education in Poland is a kind of teaching and learning how to think critically about the past, about memory, and about history. I do not mean critical thinking is about focusing on only on some shameful or bad things, moments from one's own history, and to somehow opposing this mainstream official collective memory. Not necessarily, but this critical thinking about the past would require a kind of, let's say, understanding of various tensions and emotions and points of view to on the past that that we share with other groups and other people, but the divisions also are created on this basis. And I believe that it actually makes one's own perspective, individual or national or whatever, actually it makes it stronger and not weaker when we introduce this ability to distance, to encourage many points of views. And in this context, I think that a museum space, like the space of the Warsaw Rising Museum we started our conversation with, can be a wonderful space for training this critical thinking about the past. I believe that when we visit this kind of space, like this kind of exhibition, we can try, for instance, asking questions. Why this room is arranged this way? Why this wall is painted red or black? Or why it's so loud in here? And what can we distinguish when we listen carefully to what we hear? How does it make us feel? How does it play with our emotions? How is this general atmosphere, the vibe of the place created? And what kind of, let's say, this remembering community it shows or creates? And I guess that in this context, the museum space can be a laboratory of thinking critically about the past, but also about memory, about how memory is being constructed and how we are the part of it.
I think that's a really excellent point and a great, I think, ending for our discussion on how these contested memories and these sites can be a way to get us to think more and to force us to actually question the how we see the past. And I do agree very much so that critical thinking is very important, and you know, not only in history, in many fields when we talk about education, but it definitely is important here too. So Maria, thank you so much for joining us here on Talk Eastern Europe, and we really do appreciate your insights, and we look forward to catching up with you again, hopefully sometime soon.
Thank you so much.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
And that was our interview with Maria Kobielska from the Jagiellonian University in Krakow. And let me remind that this episode was powered by the European Commission and the Europe for Citizens program. If you want to know more about contested histories on site, and if you would like to further understand and address the complex legacies of Europe's totalitarian past, visit the project's website, www.contestedhistories.org. And you can also sign up there to their newsletter to receive all updates about this project. So we highly recommend to all of you to do that. And yes, I think that's it, what I wanted to say, Adam, but maybe you have some last thoughts about the interview or about the topic we touched in this episode.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed the discussion that we had with Maria. And it was interesting to hear, you know, the discussion about how memory, you know, doesn't always have to divide. It can also be a bridge for societies, and that sometimes it's a good thing to debate history and to debate memory and to maybe not always agree on things, and that, you know, we try to build a consensus around how certain events played out in the past. We may interpret things differently based on our knowledge as it grows, or as our sensitivities change, as our perspectives change. So I really enjoyed our conversation with her, and I think it was a great insight into how memory is approached, not only in Poland, but, you know, and even in this wider scale, looking at this topic, this topic of memory and contested history, indeed contested history.
I totally agree with you. This is what we can do always to study history, to talk about it, and even if it is used for different political purposes, and we might not like these purposes, still we might be ready for another type of debate. Yeah, I know this is quite idealistic thinking, but you know, I'm trying also to always find what's possible and what depends on me.
Yeah, and I mean, so, we also have to like be aware that societies go through certain processes, certain steps of evolution. In Poland is more mature now as a society because it has managed to consolidate its identity, even, you know, for quite some time. And when we compare to other countries like Ukraine, for example, right, which had a much more difficult, or any really post-Soviet country. But at the same time, I think really looking at how these processes of consolidating your identity, confronting history, confronting certain you know, aspects of your history which are not always the most comfortable, is very difficult. And, you know, there's always going to be backlash, there's always going to be disagreements and these things. And I think the most important is that we understand that these are processes that happen naturally in society, and they continue to evolve and they continue to change, and our perspectives continue to grow. And hopefully we become more enlightened in this process, even if it feels like we're taking two steps back. But we do take one step forward from time to time. So that's, I mean,
I like what you have said, that this discussion is tough, but probably not having this discussion would be
exactly
much worse.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And I wanted also to say that we are still in touch with the organizers of the project. So maybe there will be a couple more episodes about this topic. And if yes, I think it won't be also Central European perspective presented in this project, which is also interesting because, as you have said, all countries from this region have some kind of experience. But if we took into account other and Western European countries, it might occur that, you know, they have gone through similar processes, and maybe having even broader perspective can enrich our domestic discussion about that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. Okay. Well, I really enjoyed this project, and I do also want to just say thanks to the organizers for allowing us to have a small part in it. I think it's really great that they reached out to us as well. And I hope our listeners that you all enjoyed this discussion and, you know, memory issues and history. These are topics that we always cover in New Eastern Europe because it is so important to this region. So I'm really glad that we managed to make this connection as well. And so with that, Maciek, I think we can head to our final section of the podcast episode, which is always looking at the announcements and if there's any news that we want to share. Maciek, anything that you have on your mind that you want to share with our listeners, our dear listeners?
I'm not really sure when this episode will be published, but for, I think, 1 week or so, we will be both on holiday. So this is the most important news, personal. Sorry for that for us. So there might be a short break in issuing, in publishing next episodes.
Yeah, that's true. Well, it is the summertime period, so things are a little slower as always. But I think, you know, once we get back, we will be recharged, and we have a lot of ideas that we've been discussing lately. I hope we manage to achieve at least some of them.
One thing maybe, which I would like to add, I think that in the near future we'll have more and more episodes inspired by some books that we are currently reading. And this is also interesting development because recently we got some emails, some invitations from different publishing houses to, you know, to get in touch with them and talk about the books that covers also in some extent the issues from the region, which is very nice development for me personally.
I'm taking one book with me along on my holiday, so I hope to have it done, and then we're in touch with the author, so we can interview the author, and I think you were finishing one as well. And we have, I think, some other ideas. So yeah, definitely stay tuned for that. And also, if you know you're listening to the podcast for the first time, or you're a relatively new listener to the podcast, I do want to remind all of you out there that this is largely a listener supported podcast. So each month we receive donations from our special listeners, our patrons, who donate to us via our Patreon page, and we are currently at 31 patrons, hanging steadily. But if you are interested in joining us, please do head over to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/TalkEasternEurope. The link is always in the beginning of the podcast episode. We'd love to have you join us on our Patreon page. And with that, Maciek, I just would like to also say thank you to our special patrons, who we offer additional benefits, of course, not just supporting the podcast, but we have meetings, special exclusive meetings on Zoom. We have special gifts, depending on how much you support the podcast. So I just wanted to say thank you so much for your support and for staying with us to our patrons, including Tom, PM, Eleanor, Olaf, Ian, Marina, CB, Pat, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Anastasia, William, Pavel, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Scapeghost, Wilhelm, David, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. This is what we call the special patron shout out in our podcast. And if you would like your name in that shout out as well, please feel free to support us by joining us on Patreon.
Name or nickname, because you don't have
That's
to
right.
reveal your personal data with us.
That's right.
I would like to join you, Adam, in saying thank you to our patrons. This is so important to us. And maybe one thing I would like to add, that this is really like kind of a bond we have with patrons, because sometimes they also inspire us what could be the next topic or some ideas for
yep.
further episodes.
Yep.
So we really appreciate this support we get from patrons, which is not only financial, but also this kind
moral
of contribution.
Support. Moral support,
moral
and
support.
Idea support. Yes, yes. It's really, it is a multifaceted, multidimensional support, and we are really grateful for it. And in fact, the program we're using, we recorded the interview actually from the studio in Warsaw, so you'll hear that, that it says we invited Maria through online, but the program we're using right now to record our intro and the outro is a new program that we recently invested in. And I think you can already tell that the quality is already better than our previous one. So I'm very grateful for the support of our patrons. There are real results from their support.
Yeah, and I like this software because there is also vision.
Yeah, we can see each other. Okay, so thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Talk Eastern Europe. Please stay tuned. We'll have probably a short break for the next week or two, but we will be back with a lot more discussions on issues related to our region of Central and Eastern Europe. Thanks for sticking with us.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.